Greetings, fellow investigators, and welcome back to our video podcast, Into the Darkness, where my friends and I play the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. I'm your host, Tom Rayleigh. Our campaign is Beyond the Mountains of Madness, and this is episode 16. It was written by Janice Hill and Charles Ingen, along with others who are listed in the credits. Our GM for this campaign is Sean Little, and Mick Swan will be giving the recap. The word of the day is discovery. The players are ready. Let's begin our journey into the darkness. Nick?
Thank you, Tom. Years ago, as we sat about the fire, high in the mountains, our Sherpa guides would tell me tales of evil spirits who dwelt beneath the earth, ancient monstrous things biding their time, waiting to come again. Further south, the Hindus spoke of a procession of ages they call Yugas, which lasting for many millennia, and signifying mankind's inexorable march towards chaos and oblivion. We are in the last of these ages, they say, the Kali Yuga, the age of darkness and ignorance, where God abandons mankind to its fate and evil claims the world. A digression, I know, but recent events have made me wonder about certain aspects of that belief. Could it be that we are not the first sentient creatures to walk the earth? Have other beings preceded us? Are we simply one age, one round among many in an ongoing cycle of genesis and catastrophe? Some of my more scientifically minded companions seem to think so. Our excavations have uncovered yet more of these elder things, as we have taken to calling them, less damaged than the other two, and each seemingly accompanied by a curiously worked stone in the shape of a star. Once that was finished, we were tasked with the grim prospect of exhuming the remains of the previous expedition from beneath the cairn. It is a dreadful undertaking. Some of the bodies have been mutilated and dissected in the same manner as the dogs. Even more alarming is the discovery in the course of the initial autopsy that these things had brains, highly developed, five-lobed brains. Debate is raging about this. Were they sentient? Did they? I can't even bring myself to write it down. The thought is too awful. I ate my dinner that night in silence and took myself off to bed early, my brain reeling. The following day, we left for the drill site straight after breakfast, enthused by the announcement that the drilling crew had broken down into the cave below. The cave itself was an extraordinary place, a treasure trove of fossils from the Cretaceous to the Eocene. The floor and walls are absolutely plastered with. Paleontologists were beside themselves, agog at the sheer variety of finds. At Moore's behest, we headed further into the cave, where we found what appeared to be the trenches from which the elder things were cut. Shockingly, the geologists estimate that the things were cut from a level concordant with the Precambrian era. We were contemplating the layout of the cave network and attempting to formulate a plan of action for its exploration when Dr. Hawkes came upon another star-shaped rock embedded in the wall of the chamber. Mr. Brixton promptly dug it out, a smaller, grey version of the rocks we found with the creatures, embedded with the fossils in the wall of the cave. I'm not a scientist, but by God, such a discovery could turn our understanding of life on Earth on its head. This is the find of the century. But I still don't know whether I should be elated or terrified by its awful, almost unthinkable ramifications.
Thanks, Mick. So, you've discovered the stone, the small stone. What would you like to do now? I'm assuming you're all down in the cave now. Or is Elmer not in the cave?
No, I think I'm there, yeah. Because okay. I would think I was trying to survey the cave as best.
Yeah, do some mapping, okay.
Well, I would say this place has been preserved. We need to leave it this way. We actually could consider sending another expedition later on, specifically for this site. And we're talking about this could be years of research and work just on this one small portion of cave alone.
Are you Are you saying this out loud? Or
yeah, it's a professional recommendation. We don't want to go damaging it or changing it or, you know, things just as little as picking something up and putting it down somewhere else will wreck the evidence, or at least damage the evidence of what area it came from, what position it was in. All of this has now become extremely important.
I would, you know, my professional opinion is I would agree as well. I think that we could do some cursory explorations of the caves, maybe map them out a little bit more, maybe light, you know, put some more lights in. But I really think that we don't want to dig anymore. I don't think we want to move things around. I don't know if we would have time, to be honest. But
right.
I think that we could still, you know, get things ready for the next expedition, so to speak.
I think we're in that situation wherein we can't change the parameters of what our original mission was.
Yes.
As much as we would kill to do it,
we'll just have to make sure we're on the next expedition.
Right. Well, I'll head the next step.
Yeah, exactly. Now.
Well,
everything I have to.
Bottom line is with the discoveries that we've made, we can guarantee there's going to be another expedition. Mm. So, yeah, I mean,
multiple expeditions.
Yeah, I mean, we might as well just leave this stuff for the next people to mess with, and let's get on with what we're here to find, whatever it is.
Still, from just standing here, I get out my notebook and I make write down as much detail as I can, you know, what I can see just by observing.
Get the photographer in here.
There you go.
Who has the stone now? The one that I picked up from the wall.
I do.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say the less people walking around here, the better, I guess. No.
Well, you know, a couple of us can stay and just see if we get some sense of where this cave goes or how extensive it is, but obviously we don't want to get lost and we don't want to really go exploring. We want to just come to a point where we go, holy crap, this goes on for miles and miles maybe, and we'll just go come back. We don't have time. But well, I suppose what we can discover in an hour is sufficient.
Okay.
What is our initial... What are you saying we should be doing then? Are we abandoning them, this cave?
Well, the original mission, at least as far as the drilling goes, was we were trying to find out if Antarctica was one or two continents by drilling through the ice and seeing if we hit water.
Yeah, but that expedition is long over. We're now on the expedition of the Elder Ones, so... I mean, because that's going to trump any scientific discoveries.
What expedition of the Elder Ones?
What I'm saying is we came here for one thing, but since we found these the Elder One things that you guys are calling them, that's going to trump anything else that we're going to be here for. That's going to be what's going to put our names in the history books.
Yeah, no, we can't change what the parameters of our expedition. Just because we've made a discovery, we can come back and look at the discovery later. We have to continue with what we're supposed to be doing.
Well, we also answer the Starkweather and more.
Right.
If I might interject, I would very much like to find out where the air current circulating through these caves is coming through, coming from, rather. Just from a professional standpoint, and I think for the good of the mission, if something untoward happened to the previous mission, and there were some sort of passage leading elsewhere in the cave, leading above ground again, that could be linked. What they found, what happened to them, could be linked to something they found further on.
Right. I tried to kind of start down that road last, you know, when we last talked, you know, I was trying to figure out where the air currents were they leading in a certain direction, were they coming in, were they coming out, you know, because I still think there's some cursory exploring to be done here.
I don't think it needs to be a major dig. The problem is if this is an entire cave system and there is access to the outside somewhere else, it could be 10 miles from here. You're very in basically so. A giant straw, and the air is just blowing through it, but the other end could be a long way away.
Yes, I would agree with you that any exploration we make, any sortie into the caves should be finite in aim. We shouldn't aim to be pushing all the way through. Just if we can get an idea, as you say, of the scale of the cave network.
Perhaps an expedition of 1 hour forward into the cave.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. 1 hour in,
and then 1 hour back. But make sure that we've got a way of making absolutely sure we can find our way back, like a rope,
breadcrumbs of some sort.
Because
should I hate to say, if you're going to go, you should bring some protection with you as well. God knows what you guys could run into down there.
Ice. Well, I've got my Luger with me.
Well, we have arms, but it's very, very, very unlikely that you're going to encounter anything alive.
Yeah, there's not really any predators on this continent.
What would they eat? There's nothing down here to eat.
Did you guys not see the footprints?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's the footprints, but...
But were they fossilized footprints or fresh footprints?
They were fresh footprints in the snow.
Look, well, there's no indication that they came here.
Well, all right. Footprints down here.
I'm so sorry that my brain just can't seem to wrap itself around the idea that these Precambrian fossils came to life. However, we do have the footprints. You are correct. We should arm ourselves. There's no problem in arming oneself. Yes,
I'm just saying. I pat my rifle on my shoulder. I'm saying, I'm armed. I believe Nigel is armed. You don't have to be armed if you don't want to.
As
I'm always armed.
As preposterous as the idea is, we've seen some very strange stuff in the last couple of days. So let's be armed. And be quiet, because we might hear something coming before it hits.
And it's not just a matter of whether these things are alive or not. That's beside the point. Something did in the party before us.
Well, so. Don't be surprised if you encounter humans that did this.
Okay, fine. We've got one person who is missing.
How are we going to mark our path?
Well, I mean, I have rope, but I don't think it will be enough rope to.
This is a limestone.
An hour's travel.
This is a limestone cavern.
In Elmer's surveying equipment, do we have any sort of like chalk?
Well,
something that could be used to leave a large mark.
I have bits of chalk. I have bits of ribbon, and I'm also creating a map too. So,
well, Captain Sugden has a pick, yeah, mountain climbing pick.
I do.
This is a limestone cave. The walls and the stalactites and everything are made out of calcium carbonate. It's almost like chalk. You should be able to just scratch an arrow.
True.
Granted, it's not exactly the ideal thing, but
well, in that case, I will defer to your expertise when it comes to placement. I wouldn't want to damage anything of value.
Well, how about in the floor? Make three parallel lines in the tradition of Arne Saknussemm from Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Well, I think if we do arrows, I think they can be used by future expeditions.
Okay. So, rules. Nobody wanders off. You could wander around a corner and never find your way back.
Right. Everybody carries a gun. Everybody carries a light.
And if we reach anything that's too dangerous to traverse, we don't traverse it. Keep your eyes on your feet.
And, you know,
easy to trip.
Stay within keep within eyesight of all of us. Nobody should wander off too much. You know,
is Mr. Moore with us?
Yes. He's wandering around. Yes.
Well, he's a geologist, so he's probably
freaking out. He's ecstatic.
Too. Yeah.
He needs to be taken to his fainting couch.
So who's all going? All of us right here? Right now?
Yeah, I'm in.
Great. Nobody left behind to tell you.
And no one was left to tell the tale.
We can assume that we've got this huge crew. There's probably the other paleontologist here.
Yeah, we're not. It's not just the six of us by ourselves. There's plenty of activity in the cave and other people doing their jobs. Right. And so,
well, we'll let people know that we're going, and we'll tell them where we're going.
When they should expect us back.
We're just going for a walk. We may be some time.
Oh, jeez. That's my favorite story of Arctic exploring.
We're just popping out for some ice cream. Mm. We may be some time.
All right.
We're going on a penguin count. We'll be back in a minute.
Okay. So you're going on a wander, Professor Moore says. Please be careful. We can't afford to lose anyone, and I mean lose or lose. So how long do you expect to be gone before we should start?
We will be back in 2 hours.
2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And my guess is we won't get very far in an hour.
All right. Well, on with you then. Just be careful. We've got a lot to do here, so we'll certainly be here when you get back.
Okay, cool.
So you're free to wander. So the passageway, I mean, it certainly does branch out in various directions, but there is a main path.
We're heading against the wind, so.
Yeah, and that's the direction I was assuming.
I'll lay down a mark every 30 feet or so.
Okay. You find it, even shortly after you start, to be almost impassable in a lot of directions. It's not a smooth, you know, Hollywood cave. It's definitely rough terrain, very rough terrain. Stalactites and stalagmites aren't really what you're having here so much as worn areas by water. And it's impassable. You have to be extremely careful because you'll go what seems to be an open pathway and boom, drops right off to a who knows how deep. And after about an hour, because really that's what it's going to come to, you do progress to the point where you can still hear the people behind you who are working in that area. You haven't made it as far as you really want to, or you would have expected to. It's just that rough of terrain.
Right.
But you do know, you can tell that given the right circumstances, you could keep going. But it's very rough going and very slow.
Do we see anything interesting or spectacular?
In areas where there's a wall or a harder rock that wasn't worn away, at the base of it where the water had flown down when there was an underground river, you see piles of shells and fossils crammed up against the edges and hardened. So it sort of leads you to believe that it's exactly what was hypothesized before, that these fossils were washed down from somewhere else during some kind of deluge at some point. That's why there's so many different different layers, different ages of fossils in the same location. Okay. But so you definitely could proceed, but it would take you a lot of time.
Well, gentlemen, it's been rather rough going. Let's head back.
Okay.
Unless somebody wants to yell really loud and see what the echo sounds like.
No.
Does anyone?
No.
I'm afraid something will answer back.
Get out, get out, get out.
Well, the return is not as difficult because you've already cleared, you know, planned your path, so to speak, and you are back where you started. And Professor Moore is there itemizing things. There's photographs being taken by Priestley and the other photographer. They're documenting things as they lay. They're a little bit of probing here and there. He just asks you how it went, and I'm just, without you having to explain it, you explain very, very easily. You're very tired. He recommends you just go on up and get some food and some rest after your long trek.
So, Sean, I'm looking at the map here, and we have Lakes Camp, and then we have the Miskatonic Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Is the drill site, would I just kind of consider that where Lakes Camp is? It's just that close?
Yes. It's like in between Lakes Camp, the width of that circle. It's that distance away towards the that's the South Pole. So who knows what direction it is? To the right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm just kind of thinking out loud while we're talking, while we're walking back. You know, we've said that we think that, you know, there was an underground stream, an underground lake. Do we think that, looking at the bones on the floor, do we think that maybe this underground river or lake might have started in the Miskatonic Mountains and is moving toward Lake's Camp? Does that make sense, the hypothesis here?
That makes sense, yes.
Of course, we don't know what the... what the geology has been like over the course of the last couple of million years. This from the seashells and stuff, this might have been actually under a sea at some point.
Right.
And well, now it's lifted up.
Well, one of the geologists, after you've given the information, one of the other scientists hypothesizes that there was probably an above ground lake at some point, and something gave way, and the lake flushed down into this underground cavern system, and therefore all the layers of fossils in the bottom would have washed down. But something would have caused that, probably, thanks, earthquakes, maybe something like that. Hard to say.
But yeah, on a continent we know very little about.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if at this time in history there's even the thought that Antarctica was at one time not covered in ice, so...
Correct, yeah. I don't know if we knew about tectonics yet.
Mm-hmm. Earthquake. That's just earthquakes. Probably what caused it. Okay, so your explorations are at an end. It is a couple of hours later. It is wearing on into the afternoon. There's a lot of explorations of the cavern system going on. So I'd say it's after lunchtime, but there's still food ready for you when you return to the camp.
Yeah.
You eat, you rest.
Yep. Both of the above.
Yep.
Where do we refresh my memory? Where did we stand on the dissection? That wasn't.
Yes, we finished. Well, at least we've gained a great deal of insight into how these things probably functioned.
Mm-hmm.
We uncovered that it has a structure that, for all intents and purposes, probably functioned like a brain. A five-lobed brain. Everything, their body seems to be bilaterally symmetrical. In other words, it's, if you cut them this way, they're the same on both sides.
Right.
However, it's all based on five. There's five ridges, five sides, five eye stalks.
Now, is there anything else that we need to do as far as the camp is concerned? We've been kind of on a fact-finding mission as to what happened to the previous expedition. I'm just kind of trying to see where we go next. You know, does Moore or Starkweather, do they have an opinion? Or, you know, because we're kind of taking those back to the ship you know, still on ice, so to speak.
They will go back at some point. There's no, they don't want to proceed in any flights, any overflights of the mountains or anything like that until Mr. Starkweather gives the go-ahead, and he's not set to return for a day or two.
Let's see. Well,
there's still a lot of things happening in the camp. Still a lot of general work preparing for that.
Has any crew started uncovering the hangar?
Yes. Yeah, good that you asked. There was an attempt, and what they found is the hangars themselves seem to be covered with a layer of ice that is impenetrable at present. They're chipping away at it, and short of using explosives, which they don't want to use, of course, they're trying to figure out a way that perhaps if they had more fuel, they could try to melt some of the ice. There's lots of discussions of what could happen to get into that, but at present, they're in a bit of a bind how to get in there.
All right, well, we'll let them keep working on that.
Well, there's lots of other activities to do throughout the day, and you can go through the motions of assisting with the exploration of the caverns and such, sort of documenting. And the day progresses, you get to dinner time, you're all doing your things, you're helping assist in preparation for the overflights that are coming. The evening, after dinner, the evening radio messages are being made available to everyone. Does anybody wish to make a message to anyone outside of in the outside world?
Yeah, to my father. Once again, giving him updates on just the astonishing day we've had.
All right. Anyone else?
I think, quite honestly, as I sit here and try to imagine my character, I imagine that I've got a splitting headache from just all of the reeling that I've done from what I've seen. I'm ready to take a nap, go to bed.
Go to your fainting couch.
It's too much to process.
All right, just a second. I have to do something here and copy. Okay. So the day the radio messages occur, you'll notice that Ms. Lexington makes a call. It's again...
In German?
No. English. But very short and loud and open, and she's not, you know, being cautious or hiding or anything like that. And she just goes ahead and makes her call. Everyone else makes their call. Bedtime comes. Everyone goes to sleep. Who is going to sleep? There's still security people. You know, somebody's on security detail, fire watch, wandering around. And in the morning, what could we roll here? I would say, could everyone please perception? Hearing? Something to do with hearing.
Listening?
Listen. Yes.
44. What is that?
Not a chance.
Not me.
There's a long walk.
I'm hearing the whistling of the wind.
Yes, I do hear.
Oh, yeah.
All right, anyone who had a success, at 5 in the morning, you hear the sound of aircraft. Not uncommon, though you're generally used to them happening at 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock where they leave and come back towards the end of the day. But these are deeper rumbling noises. These are not the engines of the aircraft you have heard before.
Uh-oh.
So it says now or before breakfast.
Here. The Germans are here.
The Luftwaffe.
And you hear a lot of yelling going on, so after a few minutes, everyone else generally wakes up, I would say. Not necessarily everyone, but more people are waking up. There's lots more noise, and eventually three large aircraft, boom, 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 pass very low over the camp. One particularly low, and you hear them circling. And then, I'm assuming... some of you at least exit your tents.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You go out to see three large junkers, you know, German aircraft. They're not unknown to you. You've seen them at air shows and on the newsreels at the movie theater. three large Junker aircraft fly and land one after the other on your landing strip. And they're marked D, BFEA, D, BFEB, and D, BFEC. And the words BARSM, period, FALKEN, Falcon, EXP are written on the noses.
We've been invaded.
Everyone prepare your papers. Well,
the German I know is Handy Hoch, and I'm more than prepared to say that.
I, for one, welcome our German overlords.
So there's snow blowing around, and they do the turn where they keep their engines going and blow snow everywhere. The heavy rumble stops eventually, and one of the pilots waves from an open cockpit window at everyone. So they look friendly. Explorers rush up to the planes as men in heavy flying leathers tumble out of the hatchways and start stretching and shaking it off because they've been in the aircraft for a long time. And you, on one of the aircraft, the middle one, the second one to have landed, you hear the sound of barking sled dogs. And as if they knew it was going to happen, Professor Moore and Miss Lexington press forward. They seem hastily dressed, and they're shaking hands with the people, and they're Germans, obviously. She seems more eager than he does. He's a little hesitant, has kind of pursed lips, kind of tight with his responses to them. And a small crowd's gathering around the aircraft.
I guess we'll go find out what's going on.
Yeah, I guess we'll go meet and greet here.
Okay. 14 men descend from the aircraft. They're very warmly dressed in different, you know, slightly different style clothing than yours, but warmly garbed. Identical dark hooded parkas. I mean, everything is very identical, very Germanic. They're warmly, sorry, there's a lot of talking back and forth between in English, German, bad English, bad German, some attempts at other languages just in case. Language, voices going back and forth. And eventually a really thin bearded older man identified as, someone says, that's Dr. Johann Meyer. He says, hello everyone, just a moment. And he climbs up a ladder and stands on an open like an aircraft door. So he's up above everyone around the crowd. And he says, I appreciate your kind welcome and hope that our expeditions will equally benefit from our shared scientific talents. I bring greetings from the leaders of my expedition and their salutations on your perseverance in the face of every difficulty. If there's anything which we can do to assist you, please approach myself or Dr. Professor Lur and state your needs. Our labor, supplies, equipment at your disposal, within reasonable limits, of course. Again, thanks for your hospitality, our congratulations on your successes, and my hope for more to come.
Does that name ring a bell with any of us? Whether it's, you know, anthropology, archaeology, occult.
Well, you would have
been a famous doctor or something?
It's Dr. Ur, U-H-R, and that's Professor Dr. Professor Ur, and Johann Meyer. You've seen their names in the newspapers. You're not exactly, well, you might be sure of their, you might know their expertise. Hold on.
Sure, anyway. I'm going to nudge Dr. Lindenbrook here and say, is this the crew to replace us? Or?
I don't know. I think you should kill them all. Kill them now. before they steal our stuff.
I see nothing.
Oops, Colonel Hogan.
Franz Ewer, Dr. Professor Ewer is an anthropologist. And Johann, no, that's the wrong Johann. A whole bunch of Johanns here.
Johann, he was
John. Yeah, it's the most common name.
Yeah. Johann Sebastian Bach.
Dr. Meyer is?
I'm looking up Dr. Meyer, but I don't. Professor is anthropologist, but he has some other background. And Johann Meyer is the head of the team. That you see, he's a doctor. You know, his background is, looks like archaeology primarily.
Okay, so we've probably heard of him.
What's an anthropologist doing in Antarctica?
Archaeologist. Oh, the other fellow, yes, sorry, he's an anthropologist, yes.
What is Moore doing?
Wringing his hands, but being very friendly.
Hmm. So he apparently knew they were coming.
Well, it seems like he found out at the last minute. That's what you're taking from the way he's acting, is that he was prepared for their arrival, but he didn't look very... Not he doesn't look unhappy, he just looks surprised.
Did they bring schnapps?
That they did.
Good. All right, they're good guys.
So there's questions and answers happening. So people are like standing around, not Professor Moore, of course, but Charlene is there now. Charlene. Somebody yells out, why have you come to the camp? Why have you come to Lake's camp with us? And they said, we're at the limit of our range, our planes can travel away from our base, and decided to see the renowned discoveries of Professor Lake for ourselves. We would have been here sooner, but there's been some bad weather across the ice cap. And of course, we've heard broadcasts from America of the accident, which happened 10 days ago, I believe. And perhaps some of our superior equipment could be of use to you if yours was damaged.
Not to mention Lexington giving you reports, but...
someone else pipes up and says, why didn't you tell us you were coming? And Meyer shrugs and says, we're here because we're invited by your gracious Fraulein Lexington. Did you not know? I'm not an expert in radio apparatus, but I'm told the Antarctic regions are like fickle with their ability to allow propagation of signals. We have heard your broadcast and found it very entertaining. Of course, our own equipment is of the highest German quality. Perhaps there's some flaw or damage in the receiving apparatus. Now, please speak with Herr Schimmler, our chief radio operator. Perhaps he can assist in determining how communications might be improved in the future.
Not very humble, are they?
They're so smug.
He doesn't go superior German techno. He doesn't do that.
Thank you.
It's so close to that.
Someone asks, what's your expedition's goals? Because, of course, your own group's goals are different than Lexington's goals. He says, our expedition was sent to conduct surveys of the Atlantic side of the continent and to trace the course of the mighty mountain range discovered by the Miskatonic expedition a few years back. We seek to evaluate the natural wealth of the continent and to determine whether it's profitable to be exploited.
And then annex it.
We're here for $1 million.
This is where we will build our UFO base.
And then make sure the only white people here.
Nice shopping, man.
Listen, the mountains are over there. Go ahead. we don't care.
We've already named them the Miskatonic Mountains, so you can have at them.
You can say that in German, Miskatonic. Just go to the Atlantic side. That's where we'd like you to be.
Someone throws out, who organized your expedition? Who are the backers?
Why are you asking all these questions? Are we being interrogated?
Oh, they're happy. There's lots of other questions being asked, but these are the important ones that seem to come out. They say, Dr. Klaus Falken and Herr Josef Barmeier have organized our enterprise with the assistance of the German government and various companies, German Airship Transportation Company, the Junkers Aircraft and Motorworks Company. That's it.
Dr. Lindenbrook is highly suspicious of sharing any information with these people we don't know.
Yeah.
Yes, now that they've mentioned the involvement of the German government, I've resolved to keep stumm and not say a word to them.
Well, anyone who's traveled the world such as yourself knows that both companies, like most other major companies in Germany right now, at this time have come under the government control. It's not a huge secret that the German government's taking over companies, or at least management of them, so that they can get the profits, so to speak, for their own purposes, whatever those could be, in 1933-6.
Yeah, I'm with Captain Sugden and Dr. Lindenbrook. I think I'll be polite and professional, but I'm not really going to be falling over myself to, welcome our German overlords, and I'm just going to, go about my business. Whatever that is. Mysticism.
Well, they...
I think, though, that we should turn around and interrogate them. Who's leading your... Well, think we're probably getting all that already.
They're getting quizzed a lot. So it's not... people are asking a lot of questions of them.
Do you know anything about sabotage?
Do you ask
their expedition? What is the purpose of their expedition? Other than, if they're mapping the other side of the mountains, why are they here?
Well, we were invited by Ms. Lexington.
For what purpose?
Well, our aircraft are larger and heavier. We can assist in the transportation materials more so than the aircraft you have, because apparently you've lost some aircraft, I believe.
So you have volunteered to use up your finite fuel resources for what purpose?
Science. We're interested in the same things you are. Our primary purpose is the mapping of the Atlantic coast, and we'd like to look into the mountains to see what the potential is for potential mining in future, perhaps, or natural materials that could be of interest to everyone.
I'm sorry, Sean, who is this who's talking to us?
Johann Meyer.
And he is the head of the...
He's the leader of the group that's with you right now. You're not entirely sure.
And he's an archaeologist.
Yes. Who is the archaeologist? Could you, Gregory Coppern?
Yes.
You're an archaeologist, are you?
Yes.
Could you make an archaeology roll?
Yes. Oh, yes. Six.
Well, that's easy then. Okay, what you know his name. And you know, are you going to share the results with others, or do you wish it to yourself?
Let me hear it first, and then I'll decide if I share it with others or not.
Okay, could everyone take their headphones off, please? Just for a moment. I'll give you a wave when it's time to return them.
Give us a thumbs up when you're...
Yep, thumbs up. All right, we're good. Are we all good?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I was going to swear at them just to make sure. Okay, this gentleman is a well-known archaeologist, as stated, but you know from your doings and your interests, he's also well known among occult circles. He has
that's why I asked a few minutes ago, because I wanted to. Yep. Okay.
Yes, he absolutely does have an interest in the occult. He is certainly someone that is well known. What does it say here? Let's just say you and he may have crossed paths in the past, or come very close to crossing paths.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly is someone that has an interest in those things.
And what's his reputation? You know, I assume back in these days, occult circles mm-hmm. were kind of small. There was probably less interest in it.
Yes.
So, I don't know if, he's under, I don't know if Himmler has come into the picture yet, and his whole exploration with the Anunnabi and things like that. So, have those tendrils started to go out yet from Germany as far as the occult?
Yes, they have. And the rumors are, you know them to be true, what other people might think of just rumors. This gentleman, Johann Meyer, he speaks something upwards of 25 languages. You know that. He's well known for being extremely fluent in all sort of esoteric languages. Or at least very ethnic languages, not the usual. Mm-hmm. His archaeological studies have mainly European and Middle Eastern things. And you also know that there's a rumor floating around that he was a junior officer during the Great War of the German Empire.
Okay. Okay.
So that's what you know of him. So I wave them back.
Yep. Everybody back?
Yep.
Right. What's the plan? Take them all prisoner and take their supplies?
They're already prisoners.
Yeah, nice planes. Nice planes. That's why they've been circling, you know, creating that circle around you.
Sleep with your eyes open tonight.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go on, you know, just among our group, I assume we're all standing in a circle. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I'm just going to say that I believe I've heard of Dr. Meyer. We've run in the same circles. And I think there is more going on here than meets the eye when it comes to their objectives. Keep your eyes open. Keep your ear to the ground. And just be careful. That's what I'm going to say.
How long did they say that they were going to stop over here?
Just they did.
Okay. So for some reason, they're trying to stay longer than their, you know, a couple days and something might be up.
So basically, if I understand it right, they're joining our expedition, right?
Well, they're not joining you any more than the Lexington expedition has joined you. The Lexington expedition merged with you into a point because you both are missing equipment, you're both having some issues, and you can help one another. And apparently on paper, you both have differing goals. In this case, these guys have differing goals as well, and they've been invited by her because perhaps.
It's almost like we're joining of necessity, not due to a common goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the environment, because of the conditions that we're under, there's safety in numbers, but everybody's going to have their own agenda, trust me.
Yeah, well, look, if you found $1 bazillion worth of gold and people just start showing up at random, there's a good chance that they're not really there on their mission. They're there for the gold. And we just hit the jackpot. I mean, we found something that's not supposed to exist that will change history. And I'm not even a scientist, but it's going to change history the way we know it for all time. To think that they're not going to want in on that would be preposterous.
Well, they don't know anything about it yet, except then we got to keep it that way.
I think you're making a very large assumption, Dr. Linda Groot.
I disagree. She's been talking to them. I bet you they know everything we know.
I think Nigel is correct.
I didn't think of that, but yes, you're probably correct. The thing is this. The reason why they came here seems obvious. This whole game that we're playing here. Granted, most of us, it's for scientific discovery, but for others, it's about publicity. And if they can say, oh, we helped the poor Americans out because they were having trouble, but aren't we generous and kind? That looks very good as a propaganda statement, you know. Also, they want to know what we're up to. They want to know what we've discovered.
And I also would just tell you that I think there's a little bit more of an esoteric.
I was going to say, isn't the Germans real big into the occult?
No more than anybody else is.
I think that's not right. I think that the Germans had a very distinctive interest in the occult.
Well, that's what we know now. But we may not know it in game at this time unless you have occult knowledge. That's what I would say to that.
Even then, somebody who has that kind of knowledge, kind of interest in the occult is kind of unpopular when you're... I mean, if we're talking about Hitler and the Nazis, Hitler's rise to power, most of Germany at this time is Protestant and Catholic, so...
Right. Right.
You don't
want to mix in history with game knowledge at this time. That's the danger here.
I'm just saying that scientists can be incredibly unethical about stealing one another's work.
Right.
So,
and I'm telling you that I know for a fact that they have another agenda here.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, play your cards close to your chest. Be very careful about who you give information to. I think us within this group, we're fine. But I do not think that anything we come across really needs to be shared with the with them at large.
No.
Let's put it that way.
I would also suggest we all go around armed from this point on.
If you weren't already, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you weren't packing before.
We should also keep an eye out, too. If they start talking to other members of the expedition and stuff like that, because we've had so many problems coming here with sabotage, stuff like that. So
We have certain advantages, and that some of us are scientists. The average, for instance, when we were in the cave, there's only a few of us. Now, I don't mean us. We might all be educated, but a lot of the other people who were with us digging and changing things and doing that, they wouldn't even know what to tell the person.
Right, know? Right. I mean, I don't. I'm a pilot. I don't know anything about strata and shells and fossils and stuff. So what would I tell them?
Yeah, right.
Like, go stuff yourself.
But I do think that it's an opportunity to make friends with them, get them drunk, and see what they know.
Well, as you guys are talking and speaking and hypothesizing, Dr. Myers, he sort of calms the crowd with a big smile and says, "I regret that we must cut this short. Two of these planes must be unloaded for the return to our base." They bring out a camera, and they ask randomly, who the heck could it be? 1, 2, 3. They just ask Nigel, they call you. Someone walks over and says, "Could you do us a favor and take a photo of us, please?"
That's innocent enough. Yeah, I'll take a photo of them.
So they get together with Professor Moore and Acacia Lexington. They're shaking hands, all big smiles, like they're cutting a ribbon almost. And you take the photo for them. It's very simple, easy, good Germanly and German engineered camera.
I make sure the photo's blurry.
So then they set about unloading the tri-motors as you guys start getting ready to have your breakfast, I guess. Do your normal morning things. After about an hour's work, 9 drums of fuel, 2 teams of Greenland Huskies and sleds, and about a half a ton of other supplies are just in a pile. So it takes a little while for them to do that. They start working and setting up their tents. Could someone make a spotlight hidden, though?
Sure, I got my beady eyes on them.
Oh, 6!
Nice.
28. Pass. 6 okay. Is better.
Well,
just one of us?
You both see it? What did you see, Greg? Oh, sorry.
No, I failed.
Give it to Nigel. He had a good...
Okay. You, Dr. Lindenbrook, you see... They seem to be careful with some of the things they're moving around. You can't quite see what's... They're not hiding it. They're just sort of not making it out in the open. But Nigel actually does see that there's firearms. They actually have firearms. We're not talking Gatling guns and, you know, Panzerfausts, but certainly they have personal weapons. It's not uncommon because, I mean, both other teams also people have firearms here and there. It's just... Now you know that they actually have come armed as well.
Yeah, because it's like, what if those are, what are those Gatling guns for?
Yeah.
Hey, I have something to show you.
Stay out of our kitchen tent. So about 3 hours later, you guys, you're having your breakfast, you're doing your normal morning things, and they've set up their tents. You also notice that there's lots of oxygen tanks and masks that they've unloaded. Estimations, Captain Sugden, you just count. And you say, oh, that's about enough for 10 men with air for several days at extremely high altitudes. They start setting up a guy pole and aluminum masts, a 40-foot tall radio tower, bigger than the single American one, 20-foot pole. Thim, the radio man, secures and feeds. Oh, sorry, that's a dog guy. He feeds his dogs not far from the German camp. He seems to feel no need to be able to dog corral. These well-trained German dogs stay right in their spots.
So it almost sounds like they're setting up base camp here for an assault on the mountains.
They're setting up a camp of some sort, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they set their camp set up on the other side of the airstrip, so they're not right next to everybody. But they're about, 150 yards away.
when you say airstrips, you're talking about like P1 and P2, the hangar and the...
No. I mean the strips that you guys have... Where your aircraft land, the area that you...
Oh, okay. Our actual aircraft.
Was the landing strip that we had big enough for those three big planes?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think we built that huge of one.
They're not gigantic. These aren't like Junker Ju-88 bombers. These are like just larger than your aircraft, but not crazy large. Dr. Meyer, Professor Ur, they don't get involved in the camp building. They meet in one of the large tents at 6 a.m. with Acacia Lexington for an hour. Professor Moore is not listening in at the tent, but he's kind of outside sort of making small talk with people here and there. And eventually he says, they wish to speak to us. Does anyone, a few of you want to come in with me?
Sure. I'll go in.
Okay. Well, it's open to any of you.
Sure, I'll go in too.
Sure. Questions back and forth between them, friendly, no arguing, no non-confrontational. They just ask what you've discovered so far, and what's left to uncover, what hasn't been looked at, how they can help. There's no secret. You don't notice any secret conversations between Miss Lexington and them at all. It just seems open, transparent. Moore doesn't ask any questions about their conversations that were had over the radio before. But they do say after, the back and forth that they're very tired. So we'd really like to know like how can we help? They're sort of directing it at you guys since you've been brought in by Professor Warren.
Well, hey, we got an airstrip over here that needs to be dug out.
Oh, the hangars?
Yeah.
You haven't got to that. Okay, we can assist with that, but we do need to rest first because we've been flying for so long. And we operate under Greenwich Mean Time, and you operate under Eastern Standard Time, I'm assuming. So we're kind of not in sync. We'll have to try to work that out over time.
What have we... are we like sitting in there and they're on one side of a table and we're on the other?
They've actually purposely shoved the table to the side so everyone's sitting in a circle so that it's not a confrontational you versus us setting.
So has anybody asked if they experienced sabotage? Did none of us ask that?
No,
still
we
there.
Joked about it, but we never ask about it.
Maybe we'll wait until we get one of them good and drunk and ask them.
So they say it would be a... It's funny that he says they were 12 hours opposite because you're working on not... You're not Eastern Standard. You guys are... You're operating under the time that your ship is. So you're actually 12 hours difference, and that's why there's a little bit of a difference. He says, so we'll have to work that out because otherwise we'll be working while you're all sleeping, and you'll be sleeping while... And you'll be working while we are sleeping. So we have to figure that out.
Well, the strange sun going around like this is probably going... We'll all sink eventually.
Well, let them get some rest.
Yeah, so they certainly want to have some rest, but they're saying, look, I think we can help us. This will help us both. We can perhaps alternate shifts working on things, but whatever you want us to do, I mean, please give us some work. And there's a discussion back and forth between they're visibly tired. They excuse themselves after a while, the assumption being that when they wake up, they will assist you with the hangar areas. They say, we have a surprise for you. We think we can assist you after someone told them about how thick the ice was.
Flamethrower.
Now Moore watches them walk away. He looks a little frustrated, grimace on his face. Says, what are they up to with her? What is she up to now? And he just sort of mumbles to himself and wanders off. So she's in the room with you, and Professor Moore has wandered off with them, and they're heading back to their camp, their tents.
I want to catch Moore on his own without anybody around.
Well, he's with the Germans right now, so.
Right.
Right.
Well, since we want to get synced up, I'll probably turn in early so that I'll be fresh and up when the Germans are up.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been awake for 2 hours now. Four hours.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So we're really off.
Yeah, that's a mess. Okay.
Well,
it was so early in the morning.
I can get by with 6 hours of sleep, so I'll just stay up until they get up.
Yeah.
And then work with them for 6 hours.
Yeah, I just think it would behoove us to, you know, I understand that, you know, in the lower echelons, they're probably very helpful. They want to help, you know, but I think as you move up in the chain of command, I think the objective becomes different and a little bit more cloudy. And, you know, I just think just keep your eyes open, keep your cards close to your chest, and let's, you know, if you see something, tell somebody else. Let's, you know, let's keep the lines of communication open between us.
Ms. Lexington walks over to you guys, and she looks you all in the eye, and she says, I know what you want to know. She says, look, I'll be open with you. There's no secret, gentlemen. The Barsmeyer Falcon Expedition, they want to send an observer or two across the Miskatonic Mountains. Their own aircraft cannot make the journey. And Nigel, you know that to be true. The Junker aircraft, they're very good at low flying, carrying heavy loads, but they don't have the ability to go up in higher altitudes. They can't make the journey, so I've offered seats in my aircraft.
Why?
And she smiles a kind of a sly grin and looks at you guys, and she says, we're still arguing over the price, and I intend it to be very high. And she smiles.
So it's the price that you're after.
Oh, of course. If they want to go fly over and see what we're seeing, they're going to pay a steep price for that.
What she bothers me is that you went behind our backs and did this.
I had a conversation on the radio with everyone present, and if any one of you spoke German, you would have heard everything because I was not whispering.
Yes, and you made sure that nobody spoke German.
She didn't. She just says, I didn't know what
it's a conspiracy.
Because I don't know what you know.
They speak in English. You could have spoken English. You chose German because we don't speak German.
Just that. And if Professor Moore had asked me what I spoke to, I would have just told him. Maybe not right away. And she laughs, says, look, it's all on the up and up, fellas. I think it'll work out well for all of us. And she says, I'm going to go get some sleep as well because I was up early waiting for them, and I think I would like to be awake when they wake up and not getting ready for sleep myself. So she's going to wander off. But Tom, I have to step out for a moment if that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, if you guys want to talk amongst yourselves, I'll be back.
I still say we should pop her.
I think Mr. Starkweather already is doing that.
I say, steady on.
This whole expedition gets more and more, pardon the pun, fishy every 5 minutes. It's like, why? Why are we, you know, it's like somebody, you walk into an archaeological dig. You make the discovery of the century, and then you say, hey, you rivals, come on over here and take a look at what I found. You know, it's like, come on. They're just going to go home and say, hey, we found it.
And might leave us here to boot.
Well, the thing is that in academic circles, it's a he said, she said thing. It's like we have to be able to prove that we are the discoverers and not them. And it's all just word of mouth half the time. It's our word against theirs.
You know,
that's why I intend on sending all this information directly back to the Miskatonic.
You know, while they're all asleep, maybe we should go to all these mounds and dig up the little starfish stones and keep those to ourselves.
I don't like that idea at all. You're still disturbing archaeological digs.
Okay. My question to you is this. If we go over there and we dig them up, we have them. If they go over there, are they going to follow your rules?
Yes, it's our camp. Lake's okay. Camp is Lake's camp belongs to the United States, as far as I'm concerned. They don't have thus, any business going over there.
Thus says the heavily armed troops that just came in.
We're just as heavily armed. If they try something like that, we'll stop them.
You wouldn't say they're heavily armed, by the way. You notice they have rifles and a few pistols here and there. No, not much different than what you have, your group.
By what you said, you could dig those things all up, keep them here, and what's to stop them from slaughtering us all and taking them away? I mean, it's no, you're not securing anything.
Yeah, I don't see any need for any overtly aggressive maneuvers or grave robbing or anything else like that. I think, you know, if they invite us along, you know, I don't know if all 10 of those masks and the air supplies, you know, that Captain Sugden saw, I don't know if all of them are for the Germans or if some of our team will be going or anything, but you know, if the opportunity presents itself, I think we should join in.
Well, from what we know, at least from the preview, from the Lake Dire, the expedition before, that somewhere up there is a super plateau, but we don't know anything about what's there. We don't have any information on that. That's when the disaster struck everyone.
Right. And nobody actually ascended. That was, we knew the plateau was there due to flyovers, correct?
We assumed.
We saw it in the distance. We didn't touch down or anything.
But none of the previous expeditions have actually mounted an ascent to the mountains, correct?
They reported that there was a plateau, but that was from airplane.
Right. I'm just saying no one's gone up there and stuck a flag yet.
As far as I know, no.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure my memory was correct as well.
I also seem to recall that we're talking that the lowest pass that they found into that area was at 24,000 feet, which is taller than Everest, or at least close to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
they're going to need all the oxygen and the air supply that they can get.
I would like to see that up there.
I agree.
Okay. So they sleep for a good portion of the day. But it's still daylight because it's where you are.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And you go, you have regular duties that Professor Moore is pushing on people to, again, still continue preparations. And they eventually wake up and one by one they start doing every day, you know, their breakfasts, dinners, whatever you want to call it. And they're certainly wandering around. They're certainly doing regular, if they seem friendly. But they tend to stick to themselves. They're very professional. You don't notice anything out of the ordinary, and they don't seem to be hiding anything that you can see. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, some of us probably get on better with the scientists. Others probably get better on with the non-scientists.
And where are Ur and Meyer during all this?
Ur? Oh, Meyer's there. He's sleeping, so is Ur. I mean, they all went to sleep in their tents.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure they were still on site.
Oh, they haven't left the site. Right now, they have just woken up. I mean,
okay, got it. I just want to, when you say, I didn't know if we were talking about the lower echelons or if we were talking about Ur and Meyer as well. I just wanted to make sure.
Ah, well, I mean, I'll tell you who's who. I'll tell you, you know their names by now. I've posted this on the Starfleet page. Dr. Johann Meyer is the leader. Franz, you are Dr. Professor, is the famous scientist, the archaeologist, anthropologist. There's a fellow named Maxwell Rucker, and he's a geologist. There's Johann Benecke, he's an engineer. Martin Kleisa, which is a meteorologist, he's a meteorologist. Herman Baumann is the chief pilot of the A aircraft. Carol Breyer is the co-pilot of the A. There's Gregory Schimmel, chief radio man. Josef Stoltz is the assistant radio man. Gunter Timm is the dog handler. And there's four other pilots. But of course, those aircraft are going to leave. Those other two aircraft are going to head back. So they don't. You don't need to know their names because they're gone. But Professor Moore, at noon, just one thing before the fellows wake up, the Germans wake up, Professor Moore is making a transmission. And you can hear him talking, and he's, I will assume that at least a few of you are nearby. You may choose to call the others over, but you can share the information. Professor Moore is contacting Starkweather. He's given him the details on the arrival of the other group, the latest round of findings at the cave. Doesn't mention anything you note about the dissection of the elder things. And certainly he doesn't mention anything about the bloody remains that have been found throughout the old camp. You can hear Starkweather coming back over the air, over the radio, and he says, "Good Lord, Moore, as soon as my back is turned, you invite strangers to dinner. I must say that I don't like the idea of letting these Johnny-come-latelys share the spoils. I've had my fun, and I'll be seeing you soon. I'll whip things into shape together. We'll whip things into shape together. Look, I should be at the bottom of this little hill tomorrow night. Send a plane for me when I call again. Starkweather out." And Lexington steps into her tent for her turn at the microwave, and Moore stops her with a gentle hand and says to her again, "Please, again, we're not talking about anything but the murders, right? We're going to..." She was murders? "We're still silent," she says. "For now, just keep James Starkweather out of my hair." So she gets on the radio, make her noontime. It's very, very quiet and brief, but it doesn't seem... You can listen if you want to. It's just she's just updating her people. She doesn't mention the murders or anything like that, or the massacre. As far as you can tell, it's just a regular update message. And then Lexington's people are really throwing themselves into getting stuff ready as well, so it's like everybody who's awake is working.
Can I have a crack at the radio?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm simply going to inform my father times, dates, when the Germans arrived, what we have discovered, the chronological order of things, so that if it ever gets out, there's a record of what, who did what and when we did it. So that just seems that's the scientific aspect of it. It's far more important to me at this point. Yep. Who gets credit?
Okay. Anyone else wish to make a radio call to anyone? No?
Okay. Nope, no one to call.
Nobody loves you.
Nobody loves me. I don't care. I'm going to eat pemmican.
You've got a stash under your...
We have fresh sausage now.
Pemmican sausage. So after a while, they wake up around your dinner time. That's when they're beginning their day. Tim, the dog handler, he's looking for Fiskerson Sorensen to talk shop and talk about the dogs. Breyer messes with his plane, cleaning the windshield, brushing off snow, testing gasoline drums for impurities. Like they've got little checklists that they follow with about everything. We're going to get complaints from some German people with our stereotypes here. Baumann wanders through the American camp, making conversation, offering to help with small tasks. I mean, just anything anyone wants. It just seems very friendly. The other aircraft are restarted, and they go winging off around 7:30 in the night. At night, they return, like they're to return in about 15 hours. That's the plan.
The German planes, you said something about them leaving. Did they all leave or just...
No. Two of them are leaving. They're going to come back in 15 hours carrying supplies.
So that leaves, there's one still there.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. Nigel, can you make a pilot roll or a navigate roll?
Which one do you want?
You pick whichever's better for you.
I made it.
Okay. You, using your vast knowledge of navigation and air speed and direction that they're flying in and the speed that they left, you're guessing they probably have a supply dump about 100 miles away from the pole. You know that it's probably a cache of some sort, and that's probably where they're going first, because for them to fly as far as they need to fly, they will need to refuel partway.
Okay.
That's it. It's just, you know that there's a cache somewhere in a known direction towards the pole where they would have they'll probably have to land and refuel.
All righty.
Okay. So they're wandering around. I mean, the radio man and the meteorologist are spreading out, photographing and charting the sites you've already looked at. Meyer, Ur, Rooker, and Beneke have asked to see what's been discovered to date. And Moore naturally turns group over to some of you guys. So show them everything. We can't hide anything there. They're here.
Really?
Yep. It's open. This is a scientific expedition. We do not own this land. So we're obligated to share with other countries what we find.
Yeah, but we can share it with them later. All right. I guess I'm going to take the geologist, whatever his name was.
I'll go up and talk to Herr Dr. Meyer.
All right.
See if he recognizes me. See if we've run in the same circles. And I'll speak to him in Mandarin.
Mandarin? Now you're going to make me look up to see if he actually speaks.
Wait, the Chinese are involved in this game?
What's going on?
They're coming next.
Let me look back. Now you make me look up. I made a mistake of telling you spoke all these languages.
You did.
Now I need to verify which of these languages he speaks. All right. Mandarin. You're going to speak Mandarin to him? He says, I'm sorry. I don't speak Mandarin. That Chinese. I don't speak Chinese. No, sorry. But he does answer you in Catalan. Do you speak Catalan?
No, I don't.
We could do this all day.
I know.
But do you speak Hindi?
I almost chose Hindi as one of the languages, yes. But you, I figured he'd...
Parlez-vous France.
And I almost took Tibetan as well. I almost took Tibetan as well as Mandarin.
He does not speak Tibetan, so...
I've got Tibetan.
Really? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you get to the... He does recognize you from... perhaps a conference you attended within recent years, or perhaps a paper you had written or he had written that you had commented on. He does recognize you. You know of each other. Yeah. That's it, really.
That's all. Just explain, just exchange pleasantries, you know, let him know that I'm there.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just, you know, two lions passing in the wild.
Yep. All right. I mean, while you're talking and chatting, I mean, it's, he does sort of, you know, in conversation, one thing comes out. He just lets you know that, you know, one thing very interesting, we have these aircraft. We've actually have four of these Junkers, and we never thought they would need to get up and over the mountains, because it wasn't one of the original plans of our trip to be here. But I mean, this visit was not originally part of our plan, but it's suddenly proposed by Josef Barmeier in mid-November, 2 weeks after we arrived. So we're very happy to have made contact with you. This is great.
Cool.
He seems genuine.
Oh yeah. You know, there's no bad vibes or anything like that. Just, I'm here. Oh. How you doing? I know what you're about. Got my eye on you. Feel free to come say hey.
He says, you know, of interest also, as an aficionado of travel. Do you know we have the temporary use of a dirigible airship at our main base?
Really? Do you intend on using that to survey the mountains or perhaps aerial photography?
We're currently using it for the Antarctic lowlands. Because, of course, you can't take a Zeppelin up too high.
Right.
I'm not a pilot, but yes, but we definitely, we have a Graf Zeppelin charting the lowlands. Very excited by this. That's it, really.
Well, I would like to speak to Maxwell Rooker.
Yes.
The geologist. I'm going to speak in Greek.
To Rooker? You're making me look up Rooker. I don't think Rooker speaks Greek. But
Latin?
This is a game we're all going to play now.
Come on, GM.
Rooker. Yes.
He's
a geologist. He's in his 30s. Very businesslike. I don't want to say very German. Very businesslike.
Right. Well, very serious, yeah. Herr Rooker.
Yes.
We walk over to the edge of the camp looking up at the Miskatonics, and I say, what do you think about these strange projections? They're almost cuboid projections off the edges of the mountains. Very strange.
I don't recognize this. This is
crystal. Could it be crystalline of some sort? That big?
Possibly. If it was formed and the surface eroded, I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
You usually don't get right angles on erosion.
No, it just, I mean, you can have cleavage happening in large crystalline structures, but generally the weight of them causes them to crumble.
Right. I'm thinking we might be seeing an optical illusion. But when we get closer to them, they're not what they appear to be.
Well, that will be interesting.
That they are just regular mountain formations, and just happens that we're at a weird angle and it makes it look funny. But Mr. Moore wants me to show you something. So,
oh yes.
We discovered a cave system. You're probably already aware of it from the lake team. I'll show that to you. Yes.
Oh, I would definitely like to see that. He's very excited by this.
So
he actually smiles.
We're being extremely careful not to disturb anything because, as you will see, there is a wealth of discovery to be made there. Oh, so I take him there.
Please. Okay. So he travels with you. It's half a mile away, a quarter of a mile away. So it's a little bit of a walk. But he's right. And just note that you guys all notice that the weather is quite normal right now. But you've got reports that it seems to be that it is changing.
Do we have walkie-talkies?
No.
Okay. So we have to be careful that we don't get caught in a storm.
Yeah, but there seems to be it's like there's clouds on the horizon, and so you know that there's something there. It seems to be a little bit like weather is changing a bit.
And the weather can change very quickly.
Yes.
So we make sure people know where we're going, of course.
Okay.
So,
well, you walk there. That's fine. What is everyone else doing, by the way? Just so I know, other than Mr. Copper.
Well, I'm operating under the assumption that as a mountaineer, they're going to invite me along.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem rather rude if they didn't, so I'm going to be...
we have to share our stuff with them. They should share with us.
I'm going to check my my inferior British ropes.
weak British ropes. Made with weak hemp.
You know what? I'm going to tag along with Dr. Lemonbrook. So, I think two doctors...
Okay.
Together we'll be okay. So.
Yeah, I'm...
In case we run into any of their professionals.
I'm extremely reticent to show them anything about the specimens.
Oh no, we shouldn't tell them anything. No, I don't trust them at all. I think the closer we get to things, I don't trust them at all.
I'm warming up to them, but I'm still, that's a topic we're not going to talk about. Moore even said not to talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, so Nigel, you are with who? Just so I know where everyone is.
Just hanging out in camp right now.
Okay. Elmer?
I think I would be doing the same unless there's something I can be doing.
Okay, and the doctors are together heading toward the cave. Captain Sugden, where are you?
I'm checking my ropes in the storage area.
Okay. And Gregory, I just left you out because you've been spending some time speaking with Mr. Meyer.
Correct. Yeah.
Then where are you going to head after that, just so I know, or what are you going to do?
I really don't have any agenda unless, Moore comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder and gives me one.
Okay. Well, let's say you, the doctors and the geologist arrive at the cave system. There's ladder now down. It's no longer a haphazard rope system to get down. You actually can get down in very easily. And you show him. He's very excited by the spilled contents of the fossil collection that's on the ground. He's very excited by the plethora of different eras that are present. So he's very excited. He's taking a look around. He looks at the excavation area. He said, what was in this area here? What have you removed?
We're really not sure. That was like that when we got here. So it's something that Lake's party may have done. While we're in the cave, I kind of want to look around and see by chance if I find another one of those strange star-shaped stones.
Well, he's wandering. You can do a spot hidden.
Okay. I'd kind of like to ask his opinion on what he thinks it's made out of. What is that, 66? Where's my spot hidden? No, that's a pass by about 9 points.
You don't find another star-shaped stone or anything like that. You do find an area where there's something has been dug out of the wall. Like there's a section of the stone, the soft sandstone kind of sediment has been pulled away. And there's if you look really closely, it seems like a shape of something was embedded and is gone now. Like there's nothing there.
Is it kind of barrel-shaped?
No, it's like this big, like it's tiny.
Oh, okay.
Like it's almost like maybe there was another star or something there that's fallen out at some point, but it's no longer there.
I see. Yeah, it's the we're I've already planned on probably sending back another expedition to to completely look at this cave.
Oh, he's very excited about that.
It definitely undoes anything that we've thought about there being. I mean, there must have been warmth here at one point.
Well, there's lots of rumors among those that study this region of the Earth that at one time there may not have been as much snow and ice, but nothing has been proven. We have to do a lot more drilling and excavations.
A few wild ideas about continents moving around, but that's just batshit crazy.
Well, anything's possible in the realm of hypothesis. But still has to be proven.
The continents don't float. I mean, they're giant chunks of rock. There's no water underneath. There's no way for them to move.
Well, so you show him around. He's quite excited. He's quite interested in everything you're showing him. He's making lots of notes. He's verifying that there's lots of photographs being taken. Samples are being collected appropriately, that diagrams are being drawn. He wants to make sure everyone's going through the processes they would go through if they had discovered this themselves. And obviously you're verifying that kind of information. He said, just in casual conversation with him, you do actually get this little bit of information. Apparently, in addition to their main base and the Weddell sea ice, they have two other caches of fuel and supplies. He just emphasized that there's a large one at the South Pole, and there's a smaller one about 200 miles away. It was dropped end of November when they first tried to find Lake's camp. He says, we tried to find this camp. We were unable to. So we did actually do a flyover, but we weren't able to find it. You're very lucky that you found it.
Well, and I exchange, you know, our credentials, and mm-hmm. I mean, we can be friends.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't given you any reason to not be friends right now. Okay, now let's flash while you're talking, let's flash over to Elmer and Nigel. You guys are just wandering around doing everyday work things, keeping your eyes out. And you do notice that this one, that there's some people just wandering. There's some friendly German type wandering around, like not Ruger, Baumann, the pilot. I mean, there's chatty fellows. He says, hey, we have something to show you. I've heard that you guys are having some trouble getting through some of the ice.
Yeah.
He says, come over, come see this. This is the most amazing German implement we've developed. And he says, we call these the Barsmeyer Falcon ice knives. And they pull out this simple thing. Like, it's a box. It looks simple. And you look at it, you think right away, I could have invented that and made my million. It's a 10-inch loop of heavy copper tubing. They show they have long cords to this generator. Turn it on. And over time, this cord heats up red hot, 10 inches long. And there's a pump that removes the liquid that's melted, so like a little channel, so that as you're cutting, you can cut. He says, shows you on the ground. He cuts through the ice of the ground.
Well, that will help clear the hangars.
He says, that's what I've heard. You've had some difficulty with the hangars. I say we should get a group of people together and make some short work of this hangar issue.
All right, let's do it.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, he says, these are very convenient. They're very flexible, and they're small enough to use in close quarters. He says that they have, you could probably, you know, 3 or 4 hours you could clear that. So I've taken a look around it. 3 or 4 hours though, with a couple of people, you could clear that ice out of there. But he does know that you could only take small pieces at a time. You can't carve large because they're only 10 inches long and they cool down. You have to cut and let them warm up again and cut. But it's certainly better than using a chisel or a shovel.
Yeah, well, let's get to it.
Okay.
German ingenuity.
Marfanugan.
So yeah, I guess he says let's get some people together to go working on this these hangar areas that the maps that we've seen, these should be hangar areas, so we should go in and cut that open.
All right.
Okay. So just note that this is getting close to like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So you guys are, unless you actually slept earlier in the day, like went back to your tent to sleep for a bit, you are starting to get a little tired. Okay, Captain Suggan, your ropes are awesome.
Nice. You
checked and double-checked your ropes. The twists are just perfect. You're very sure these are just as good, if not better, than German ropes.
Okay. I'm suitably proud of that fact.
What are you going to do now?
Well, it's getting on a bit, isn't it? I mean, it's...
yes.
I've got nothing else to do, so I'll probably turn in for the night, I would imagine.
Okay. The Germans are being very respectful of everyone's wishes to sleep, let's just say. They're not being very loud, and their dogs are very obedient and quiet.
That's nice to know.
I'm curious if they're just called shepherds in Germany.
I know what they're called. Now I don't huskies. Remember.
Well, they wouldn't. They wouldn't be German shepherds.
They'd be huskies.
Right.
Oh, that's right. They're Greenland huskies. Alsatian is what you call a German shepherd.
Malamute.
Alsatian.
No, Alsatian was what they were called during the war in England. Because they didn't want to call them German.
Oh, what says here in Wikipedia?
Oh, they're called Schafferhund. The Schafferhunds is Schafferhund?
Okay.
Schafferhund.
Yeah. Schafferhunds.
What's Schaffer?
Schaffer.
Shepherd. Like shepherd hounds.
Shepherd dog.
Shepherd hunt. Okay, shepherd dog. Okay.
Schafferhund. Deutsche Schafferhund, I guess.
Thing. All right, so, yeah. So they...
I could be wrong.
My German's fallen away over the years.
I can ask my ducks hunt.
That means hot dog.
Oh,
badger dog.
Just a second, sorry. Deutsche Zuschauer. Es tut mir so, so leid. Carry on.
Okay.
I can guess what you might have said. And we do apologize for... Yes. It's just a game.
So you're whipping around Nigel and Elmer. They've said, let's get a team together. We'll head down and start working on this hangar. But Mick is tired. He's gone off to his tent. You too also. I mean, unless you did sleep early in the day, it is getting on. But you're certainly excited at the prospect, so you're not going to miss out on seeing these things in action.
Just for the listeners, Nigel and Elmer were having a private conversation about sabotaging the German planes.
Yeah.
Should it need to come up, that's all.
Actually, the big problem right now is their planes are in front of ours, so we have to move their planes to get ours out.
Was he saying that their planes are not able to climb to the altitude, or was he saying
they can't get up as high as ours can?
Okay, that's what I thought.
The problem with all airplanes,
and also the Zeppelin can't either.
Yeah, no. That is Sean.
Is there Zeppelin helium powered or hydrogen powered?
Hydrogen, are they not?
Probably.
That's why they go...
That's what I was wondering.
The biggest problem would be
if they're helium.
The higher up they would go, the more the bags would expand, and there would come a point where they just couldn't go any higher, otherwise their ship would just tear itself apart.
But that also means they probably have hydrogen store somewhere.
Yes, in big giant bags inside the
dirigible. Big giant bags that are floating up in the tent.
I'm going to show my rope to some Germans.
Oh, you pervert.
You go to bed.
God, I hope that's not a euphemism.
Das ist ein gutes Seil.
And they'd be like, but yours twists to the left and ours twists to the right.
I'm not sure. I may have just said, that is a good ropes.
Well, let's continue.
To all our viewers, if you know what the heck Mick just said, please leave it in the comments below.
If it really does speak to rope.
We have a fairly large German population.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
And we love you. Please.
Yes,
please
I'm genuinely sorry. I feel
German.
That my terrible apologies in schoolboy German may have exacerbated the whole issue. I think I might have created more problems than I've solved.
Please direct all letters to Mick directly.
Herr Mick. Yeah. Herr Swan. All right. Go ahead, Sean.
You wander off. He's heading back to his tent. He's very excited, talking, jabbering away about what you've showed him. And when you get out to, you see the camp. You see there's a group of people heading towards the hangar areas, and they're trailing a generator on a sled behind them, and they're very excited. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned is, And you've noticed this now, the Germans have arrived with their dogs. Every time dogs go anywhere near the lake camp, if they approach a tent or a former tent or a building, former area, where the elder things, as we call them, were located, the mm-hmm. dogs freak out. They're not happy.
They don't like
the smell. Dogs cannot be contained. Yep. They don't like the smell, and the tent where the dissection and the storage is occurring, they won't even go near that. You have to bring them in a wide berth around, or they're uncontrolled or almost uncontrollable. And the Germans are like, what's going on? Why are the dogs like this at first? And until the dog handler has a little talk with them, and they essentially eyes grow very wide, but they learn how to deal with it.
Yeah, tents full of dissected dogs. They were all dead when they died. I mean, they were all alive when they died.
Chemicals. Well, we probably spread the concept that there may have been some sort of a disease or contagion. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're not doing anything in that area right now.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was just saying, yeah, we would have to take and let them know that there's a possibility of contagion, because that's still an underlying theory that we have, that it could have been from a contagion, that whatever happened from some kind of a contagion. And that's not faulty. Just because we found these things doesn't mean that they didn't cause the contagion.
Right. So we'll just leave it at that.
So, Sean.
Okay.
We were looking.
So, a crowd of people gathered around. There's a generator. You see these fellows have these round sword-like objects, 10 inches long, and they flick on the generators on, they flick on the power, and there's a little tube underneath it. As you approach, you just see they've already explained it to everyone else, and Elmer and Nigel are like, they're ice knives, watch what they do. And they turn it on, and they just stick it into the ice, and they cut a chunk out of the ice. It actually cuts through the ice. They say, this will make this work much easier.
That's phenomenal.
That's jolly clever.
Professor Moore is like very excited. He says, please, this would be amazing. He says, what's the estimate time for this to clear this area? These former hangars, you say they are? And the Germans, they do, how many we've got, how many people? They say, if you could give us two people, we can have these cleared out by morning. Your morning, not ours. And Professor Moore says, that's amazing. That's wonderful. So he says, who has had enough sleep that they're willing to stay awake for another 6 hours?
I'm willing to do it.
All right.
Sure.
Well, they can find someone else too, I'm sure. And Elmer, you want to?
Sure.
Okay. Well, they're going to set about it. So they believe that this is something that they can absolutely be done by morning. So Professor Moore says, look, we've got, let's try to resync our sleeping patterns so that we can be a little more in line with one another. So I would suggest everybody get to sleep as soon as possible, and any of the other teams that want to realign should probably try to work that out as well. So he suggests everyone goes to bed, and the work is continuing. So what's everyone going to do?
Go to bed.
Who do we have an engineer on our team?
Yeah,
our engineer.
Sure you do. I sent you the team list.
Yeah, I do have the team list here. Hold on.
I do too. I just have to find it.
It's right in front of me.
It's in front of me too, but it's like, page 300 and something.
Engineer. Here we go, engineers. Let's say Lawrence Longfellow.
And he's arrived. He has already arrived. So, he was one of the people that arrived today on the 3 o'clock air flight.
We were friends back. We played poker together on the ship, as well. Yes. Lawrence, he says, what about redesign?
Yes.
See that thing that you got there? That knife. Couldn't you like redesign that so that this was heating up while this was cutting, and then when this cools down, cut with this one, and this one heats up? so that you could continually cut instead of having to wait for it to heat back up.
Huh, that's an interesting thought. I'll go work on that before I go to bed. I've got my slide rule.
All right. I'm going to do that.
Okay. So we'll skip ahead a bit. The work is progressing. And in the morning, I'd say Nigel, you and Elmer, you guys last till 2 in the morning before you're pretty darn tired. So you probably skip off and go to sleep as well for a few hours, I would assume. So it's not like there's certainly members of your team, you know, present during the work occurring. So it's not like the germs are working on their own all the time. There's absolutely a desire to work together.
Okay.
So morning comes, morning arrives, and there's a lot of excitement. You can hear a lot of noise, and there's breakfast. You can smell the food cooking, so I would assume you're all going in for breakfast.
Yep, sure.
Okay, Professor Moore enters the mess tent. Nigel and Elmer, I would assume you guys, even though you've only slept like 4 hours, you probably just wander down too because you can smell the food. Professor Moore enters the tent, and he looks tired and not with it. Like, he's probably stayed up the whole time. He says to the few members of the team, other than you guys, the other persons from the team, say, "What?" He gets a report from them. And Dr. Meyer and Professor Uhr arrive, and they look very serious. After nodding to other Americans present, apologizing for the interruption, Meyer crosses to Moore. "Herr Professor," he says courteously, "Dr. Professor Uhr goes now to transmit a report to our superiors. The night's work has been most revealing. When you've finished your meal and your crews are ready for work, I wish to invite you to bring your workers to share the opening of a location of great interest to both the parties. Would you join me as soon as you're ready? Please forgive my intrusion into your breakfast dining tent." And with that, the two men leave. Moore finishes his breakfast thoughtfully and puts the choice to the investigators. "I'm going to go. Location of great interest, eh? Wonder what he knows, what he's found that we haven't found. Who's in?"
I'm in.
Everybody's in.
Everybody's in, of course. So you eat your breakfast. You wander down. The Germans are all just sort of patiently waiting for you. You meet Dr. Meyer at the edge of the old Miskatonic camp. He leads you to the aircraft shelter, one of them. A section of the ice in the southern edges, there's these red-tipped bamboo, like they've got bamboo with red paint on it to indicate an area of interest. The ice within the markers has been removed, exposing a stretch of stiff and battered heavy canvas sagging into the interior. So they've done what you did before with shovels, but there's a much larger area that's deeper as well. One of the German generators and the ice knives nearby, he says, "If I'm correct, gentlemen, Meyer says, "the unbroken canvas means that the chamber beneath is still undamaged by snow. Its contents should prove enlightening. Do you think? Do you not think?" He's very excited. He's been up all night, but it's not night for them. It's the end of their day. So he says he's got half a dozen people working there now in total. So they work and they free the ice, and if 2 hours more work, they can clear it all out. So instead, he says, let's go. He cuts the canvas, and a small patch of splattered and stained ice below. You can see it right away. So who could do a archaeology role?
I will do that. Yep, I made it. 43 out of 60.
Okay. You advise them how to avoid prematurely shredding the canvas. You actually, just your knowledge of excavations, because they haven't cleared it all up, but they've cleared enough to get inside. So you actually advise them, do this, do that. That way you can get in without crushing everything. So the hangar, you get inside, you go below the ice, and it's an open hangar. I mean, it was a canvas hangar. It wasn't a metal roof or anything like that. The interior is exposed to the air. Immediately, you're all struck by a metallic odor. It dissipates in a moment, like as the wind pushes in and out and the smell dissipates. But the dogs nearby whine and start freaking out again. They don't like it very much. It's a little stronger because the use of the melters has actually heated up the air inside, so it's made the odor stronger than when you were digging them out yourself.
So it's the metallic smell of blood that we had smelled before.
Yeah, you assume it's the same sort of smell.
Mm-hmm.
So the air exchanges with the wind, the light wind that's happening, and all that. The frozen floor is covered with huge areas of pink ice. Dotted here and there, there's gobbets of some unidentifiable darker substance. You're all a little on edge because of what you've seen so far. And along the southern wall, neatly separated and displayed, are the remnants of a very messy dissection.
Of a person? Missing,
a dissection person. Of a...
You'll have to go close to look.
I'll go in.
I'll walk over, you know.
Sure, I'll walk over and take a look, too.
Yeah, maybe Dr. Hawk should take the lead on this.
Okay. Dr. Hawk, you heading in?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'll take a look to see if I can figure out what it is. Human? Animal?
Well, as you look, you see these are dog-sized spots on the floor. Organs have been separated and placed out neatly. So someone could just look and say, it's like taking apart a model aircraft and lying all the parts out in front of you. The internal organs are draped in intricate patterns and rows around where the body would have been. There's a full dog skin is lying there as well, perfectly skinned, as if someone was going to taxidermize it. There's musculature separated from bones. It's all just a full dissection. Bits and pieces everywhere. Paper-thin sections of brain, something you as a doctor couldn't imagine doing with the tools you have right now. And everything is frozen to the floor.
Yeah.
So everyone who has entered has to make a sanity roll.
Made it.
Ooh, I failed.
I can't believe it, but I made it. Holy mackerel.
Okay.
Failed by 23 points.
Nigel takes 2. Greg takes 3. Did you pass, Gregory?
I did pass, yes.
You take 2.
Alrighty.
I did not pass, but I didn't really go all the way in.
Wait, <you're sweet.
laughs> I'm just getting tired of it.
I just put my toe in, that's all.
You only took 1 anyways. You'd be used to this by now.
That's the thing. I'm kind of expecting.
Yeah.
Or
I did the same thing, kind of like looked over the shoulder.
What are you guys doing? You take 1 as well.
I'm a paleontologist, Jim. I'm not a doctor.
Could you, whoever was first, Dr. Hawks, could you make a spot hidden, please?
Yep. I failed that by 35 points.
Oh, that's a lot. Well, Gregory, could you make your roll since you're in there as well?
Yeah, sure. Just a spot hidden?
Spot hidden.
Yeah. No, I am still dealing with my sanity loss, I'm afraid.
You're just aghast at what you've seen.
Yeah.
Essentially, you do notice... that there's some rings on the floor and there's circles there. This isn't the spot hidden thing. About 3-inch wide circles here and there throughout the floor, differently colored ice. And you look closely and you see that they go like 1/2 inch below the surface of the ice. So it's like everyone, like these little circles, 9 of them. And you can't really figure out what they were, what purpose they would serve.
Are they in any sort of pattern?
Not really. They're 3 inches wide. They seem to, they're scattered around the floor, scattered, like not even. And there seems to be a pink flowing from the center of each.
Like a pink liquid, a pink gel?
It's in the ice. You can't really see without excavating further.
Pink as in a mixture of red and white.
So who else? I know that Dr. Lindenbrook is not down there. Are you in there, Captain Sugden?
No, I'm also at the doorway with Elmer and Dr. Lindenbrook.
I went in with Dr. Hawks.
Okay, well, Captain Sugden, you are the obvious person for this. Could you do a spot hidden?
I can indeed. Oh, 49 out of 50.
Ooh, good. We'll take it.
It'll work. As you're looking around, you're averting your eyes from all the gore. You do notice that there's some chip marks in the floor, and you right away recognize these are chip marks from ice cleats that someone would have worn who was mountain climbing boots, something that would have been worn to give grip. So your assumption is that most likely the dire party, the rescue party that arrived, has been in here. Like, had been in here years ago.
I see. Well, I will point this out immediately.
Okay. Moore looks around, and he says, "Dear Lord in heaven, this is horrific. This is horrific." And Myra's side is concerned and nods at what he's seen. He goes, "Herr Professor, I have information I think that you should see, and it may help you to understand. Could you leave the excavation to your men and join me in my quarters for a while?" And Moore says yes, and he asks you all to follow. So he wants you to head to the German camp.
All right.
That should probably be where we call it for the night.
Oh. Yeah, I need some fresh air anyway.
All right. Well, our players included Jerry Bryant, Greg Malcolm, Bill Mize, Rick, I can't read all of a sudden, Mick Swan, Jeff Wilkins, and myself, with Sean Little as Keeper of the Secrets. Our musical intro, Sleight of Hand, was composed by James Brett and is used with his permission. We're currently producing 4 shows a week with music and sound effects added in post-production in order to create a richer listener experience. We provide audio-only versions of our show for you to download from Podbean or iTunes. Patrons of our show can now enjoy recordings of our pre- and post-game conversations. We have a new patron, Edward Elliott, who is contributing $3 a month. Thanks, Edward.
Thank you, Edward. Appreciate it.
If you'd Thank like you. To become a patron, visit our Patreon account. Just a few dollars a month will help us a lot. Like, share, and subscribe to our channel for updates on our latest shows, and leave us some comments. We love hearing from you. This is Tom Rayleigh, together with all the members of our gaming club, inviting you to journey with us once again into the darkness for another adventure into the universe of H.P. Lovecraft and the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Until next time, good luck and good gaming.